Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Colleges and universities spent the spring and summer trying to figure out a key question. Would students return to campus for in-person instruction in the fall? Well, the question has been answered, and students whose schools decided in either direction are now facing the consequences. We've heard from administrators. This hour, we want to hear from students themselves about what college life is really like in the midst of a pandemic. This hour on Point, to be in college in the fall of 2020. With us first from Atlanta, Georgia, is Fana Haile Selassie. She is the student government president at Spelman College. Fana, welcome to On Point. How nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for having me.
So COVID-19 has changed just about everything about the college experience this year. How are you doing so far?
I think it is safe to say we're experiencing quite a transition. I'm doing well. I'm in Atlanta, as mentioned, and studying virtually from here.
So are most students in the same boat? Has your college opened up at all?
So Spelman initially made the decision to only allow incoming first-year students on campus and keep all other students at home. But upon seeing the rates, the rising rates of COVID mid to late July, they pivoted in their decision and decided to go fully virtual. So we're all at home learning and campus is not open to any students or faculty.
And how are you doing with that experience? How are your friends doing? Go ahead.
Well, I'm doing considerably well, considering the circumstances, but I can't say the same for all students. What we saw at the onset of the pandemic was that how college campuses serve as an equalizer of sorts by providing a safe living and learning environment for students. But when students return home, not every student is returning to a conducive living and learning environment. And so I want to address the inequalities that this pandemic has brought to the surface in higher education in terms of students' backgrounds.
And what would you say is the number one inequality you've witnessed?
The assumption that every student is in an environment that can adapt to virtual learning. When I returned home, I was living with my grandmother and living in her home. And so that comes with a host of responsibilities. As for other students, they may have been taking their classes and they're helping their little siblings through their new virtual classes. I know other peers who've had to get full-time jobs to make ends meet and help parents at home. So these are the things that we have to consider as we all make this transition to the digital world.
And I know you've worried a lot about the mental health struggles of some of your classmates. How have you seen that unfold?
I think what we have to acknowledge is that as a historically Black college, the number one historically Black college in the country, Spelman's community is quite different than that of other institutions in the U.S. in that we're serving a majority Black community that is also experiencing a pandemic that is disproportionately impacting us and a racial crisis. So I for one example, when we went home, not only were we hit with the reality of losing many family members and friends to this virus, but seeing our other community members slain by the police and others who were advocating for justice experienced similar interactions. It's quite traumatic, to say the least.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, so much has been going on, and especially for your generation, you've lived through the Black Lives Matter movement these last few months. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how that has impacted you and other students. Mm-hmm. As you're starting this new semester at home virtually during a pandemic.
What I've observed is my generation rallying together to have political conversations and engage in political activism in new ways. I joke and say that before the pandemic, Twitter was just a social networking site, but now it's a site of mobilization and activism. And some may discredit it as one that may not provide valid and reliable sources. But in fact, it ended up being one of my most trustworthy sources at the height of both the pandemic and the racial unrest that we experienced in the spring and are continuing to live through.
So you're at home virtually learning. I'm curious what you think when you see images of unmasked college students crowded together at parties. What goes through your mind? What are your thoughts? Those are your people. This is your generation. What do you think?
I'll tell you this. I come from a college town. I was raised in Durham, North Carolina, which is home to Duke University, raised between Durham and Chapel Hill, which is also home to University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Tar Heels. The day that I was set to return to Atlanta, I was driving through UNC Chapel Hill's campus and they had started classes. And I was absolutely both astounded and disgusted at what I saw. The number of students walking carelessly without masks, right past the numerous signs that have been put up and what I assume to be attempts to encourage students to wear masks was sobering at best. And it reminded me that my campus is not the norm and a safe space in many forms. That's my take on that.
I know that as the student government president at Spelman, you were placed on the president's COVID-19 task force there, the only student at first to do so. And I'm curious, with everything you just described and student behavior in other places, are you glad you're virtually learning this semester? And how would you rate the response of your college to the pandemic then and now?
I'm extremely grateful. As I said before, the Black community has been disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. And so Spelman was in a unique position because our administrators weren't just considering the health and safety of individual students, but that of their families and communities as well. Because given my background coming from a college town, I was so heated to see those students not wearing masks because I have elderly family members and surrounding communities.
Yes.
So I'm extremely grateful for Spelman's decision to consider the students and their families' health first and foremost.
And are you hoping to get back into the classroom, Fauna, a hybrid learning model at some point? Are you optimistic that will happen?
I think we'll just have to keep an eye on the numbers given the flu season. And I'm only going to be optimistic to get back into the classroom when it's safe for all parties involved.
And with a career in diplomacy ahead, how are you feeling about the future in this moment of upheaval, really, in our country?
It's easy to be disheartened, but considering that I am interested in diplomacy and global governance, I think what this is prompting all nations to do is to look inside at our systems and how we operate ourselves, and at what costs are you willing to risk your citizens' lives and well-being or economic advancement. So that's what's revolving in my mind as I continue to apply for grad school and programs.
Fauna Haile Selassie, student government president at Spelman College. What a delight to have you here, and I appreciate your perspective very much. Thank you, Fauna.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you. Joining me now is Andy Thomason. He's a senior editor at the Chronicle of Higher Education, author of a forthcoming book about the academic fraud scandal at the University of North Carolina and what it revealed about college sports and higher ed. Andy, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So interesting to hear Fauna's experience and what she's seen around the country and how she feels about it. The coronavirus pandemic has left colleges and universities facing these difficult decisions about what to do, how to reopen campuses. You look at this, you study this. What do you see as you look out at higher ed across the country right now?
Well, I'm so glad that you had Fauna on the show because actually, the majority of colleges that we've tracked at the Chronicle, or a plurality, I should say, about 34% are entirely online or primarily online. Spelman is an example of that. We see lower numbers of colleges. But getting the headlines a lot right now are those colleges that are primarily in person or hybrid models, having students in dorms. And this is where you're seeing mostly the huge surges in coronavirus cases.
Right. You broke up for a bit, so let me repeat what I think you were saying. You have looked at 3,000 institutions across the U.S. 34% are primarily online, 21% are hybrid, 23% are in person. Several major universities have already experienced outbreaks of coronavirus, and in some cases, just days into the fall term, right? What are the calculations for colleges and universities that you have discovered, that this balance between protecting students and faculty and the economic realities that are at play here?
Well, Jane, it's safe to say that reopening was a really complex decision for colleges. There was much financial pressure involved in doing so, involving, you know, many colleges, most colleges in American higher education are tuition dependent, meaning they rely on the money they get from tuition payments year in and year out to keep the doors open, to keep the lights on. So that was obviously a pressure. There's political pressure that we see at state colleges from the state governing bodies because reopening has become a political issue. So we saw, especially in North Carolina and Georgia, pressure from the states to at least give reopening a stab. So it's definitely a complex decision and one that colleges are dealing with the fallout right now.
And places like Wisconsin, I'm reading about, and others that are seeing spikes in their cases, broadly speaking, because of what's happening in these college towns, right? I mean, there are huge repercussions for the broader community when these college kids have spikes in coronavirus.
That's exactly right. And that's the thing that I, as an observer, am most worried about now is, can you have 2,000, 3,000 cases at a college campus and not see community spread in those college towns? Because while it's true that many college students are predominantly younger and maybe healthier, the people in the surrounding towns and employees on the campuses are not necessarily so. And so that's a big worry.
Andy Thomason, senior editor at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Stick with us. We are discussing the unique challenges for colleges and universities and how student leaders are handling it. Coming up, we'll speak to student newspaper editors whose schools brought students back to campus. We'll hear their experience. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking with student newspaper editors about what college life is like in a pandemic and how the choices their schools have made are impacting students. My guest this hour, Andy Thomason, senior editor at the Chronicle for Higher Education. Andy, we were talking about the political sort of fault lines at play, even in higher ed right now, the sort of red state, blue state, colleges in run in states by Republicans are more likely to offer in-person courses, it appears. Blue states are more online. Has that held steady throughout the opening here?
It has, but it's gotten more complex as states have to wrestle with, the consequences of reopening, the public health numbers, cases on campus, and that sort of thing. For instance, one of the first campuses to reopen, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, had faced a mandate from the system to reopen, but just, I think, about a week, after they had started classes, they were forced to shut down and effectively evacuate campuses. So the public health realities are definitely altering some of that decision making.
And many colleges and universities are not messing around. They're cracking down on these large gatherings, large parties. At Northeastern here in Boston, they expelled 11 students that gathered in a room together, and there was no refund on the $36,000 tuition. Ohio State issued 228 suspensions to students who attended parties. Give us some other examples of the disciplinary measures that colleges are taking now.
Well, much of that action has actually been predominantly rhetorical, sort of warning students, saying, this semester, if it has to end early, it's on you, it's not on us. That's the message from administrators on many campuses. There have been lots of suspensions at lots of campuses. It actually helped sort of spur something of a backlash among others in the higher education community, saying, the students didn't make the decision to reopen. It was the administrators. And are you going to blame students for being students when they didn't really have a hand in these plans? Some observers called it hypocritical.
Well, right. And you know, I've heard both sides. Is it too much to ask college students to give up so much of their college experience? And on the other hand, you know, be responsible, put on a mask, socially distance. I mean, there are two sides to this, as there are more broadly speaking in the cultural conversation as a whole.
That's absolutely true. And yes, you can see both sides to it. And of course, in a pandemic, we all have to behave responsibly, behave as good public health citizens. But you have to realize and recognize that this is occurring in the larger context of institutions that have their own institutional priorities, financial, political, and cultural. And in some cases, at least, students have sort of found themselves in the center of that and facing some of the consequences.
Let's hear from more of those students now. Joining me from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Elizabeth Lawrence. She is editor-in-chief at the Michigan Daily, the student newspaper at the University of Michigan, where she is a senior. Elizabeth, thanks for being here. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And in Boston, Colleen Martin. She's president and editor-in-chief of The Heights, the student newspaper at Boston College, where she is a senior. Colleen, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Elizabeth, I'll start with you. By all accounts, you've had a rough go of it at the University of Michigan. How would you describe the reopening process this fall?
Yeah, so chaotic to say the least. So the University of Michigan decided to bring students back to dorms and have limited in-person classes, although it's worth noting that 78% of classes present an online option. And it's been a very tumultuous semester so far. And in the past few weeks, we had a massive strike from our graduate students with a lot of classes getting canceled, picketing on campus as well as online. Our resident advisors have also issued a list of demands and went on strike. In the midst of everything, Big Ten decided to do football again this season. So it's been a lot of new developments in quick succession.
Right. And of course, the coronavirus as a backdrop. I want to play this clip. This is a student from the University of Michigan, where you are, posting a now viral TikTok about the conditions in the dorms designated for students like him who test positive for coronavirus.
We were given almost no supplies. We were given no food, no masks, no gloves, no microwave, no bed sheets, no soap, no cleaning supplies, nothing. Except we were given one roll of toilet paper, single ply. Oh, and did I mention there's a roach infestation as well?
He told reporters he was given sheets and supplies after he posted that TikTok video, but other students in the dorm still say they don't have what they need. Elizabeth, what are you hearing from students about the experience of those who have contracted the coronavirus and who are in quarantine, who are dealing with this right now?
Yeah. There have been a lot of concerns about the quality of quarantine housing, especially as Sam Bernstein said in that TikTok, the lack of sanitary conditions. And I think it's made a lot of people really nervous about even reporting cases to the university if this is where they're going to be sent, which also creates the larger concern about how accurate is the university's testing data, which is kind of a backdrop of all of this.
Right.
If students are hearing about this, yeah.
We'll get to the testing backdrop in a minute in the comments of your university president. Let me bring in Colleen Martin at Boston College because, boy, BC has had a real outbreak of the coronavirus. It's been a big story here in Boston. Colleen, how many students have tested positive so far?
The numbers are updated about three times per week. So I wouldn't want to give you the incorrect number for today, especially as they're always being updated on Fridays. We are seeing an increase in testing here at BC, or cases, rather. The Newton mayor has expressed concern at the number of cases and Boston College's testing policy. The numbers each week are updated with the amount of tests.
Broadcasting in the age of coronavirus. Colleen, we'll try to get you back. Elizabeth, go back to that testing point, because like BC, there's been a huge testing controversy. And the president of your university was criticized for comments he made. He said, we don't want students to use testing as an excuse for bad behavior. That didn't go over so well in the medical community or with students. Talk about testing. Can you get tested? Are students getting tested? What's the story?
Yeah, so currently the university is testing symptomatic students. And then also if you've been confirmed, been in contact with someone who has tested positive. And then they're also doing surveillance testing of around 3,000 individuals is their goal, but it's not super randomized. It's an opt-in system. So it's really hard. I mean, anecdotally, I've had friends who have struggled to get testing from the university. So I know some people are going outside of the university, going to testing events with the county. There's a lot of frustration with the university's dashboard and how that's being updated and whether those numbers are even accurate because we're testing such a small fraction of the population.
Right.
There's a lot of uncertainty.
Indeed, to say the least. Andy Thomason, jump back in here. I mean, we're talking about testing. It's a real challenge at the scale you're talking about at these colleges and universities. What are you hearing?
It's a challenge, and it also runs the gamut from university to university. There are some campuses that are pretty much just testing symptomatic students. That's kind of the lowest rung of a testing strategy. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have places like the University of Illinois, which is testing all students twice a week. So there's a huge variation in testing strategies. And one of the things there is that testing can cost a lot of money. Now, the cost might be coming down, but as campuses were devising their testing strategies, cost was a big factor in favor of perhaps a less stringent testing regimen. And one other thing I just wanted to add in is that while it's true that, you know, presidents bear some responsibility for a testing strategy and this rhetoric that, testing everyone on campus might give people a false sense of security. That was the CDC guidance that colleges got on testing in the summer.
Right. Colleen Martin, we have you back. It seems Boston College to this point on testing is not testing students nearly as often as other universities in the area. Even students with high contact campus jobs are not getting the testing that they need, that they want. Is that what you're seeing, Colleen, at BC?
Yes, Jane. Sorry, I lost you there for a bit. People have expressed that they aren't satisfied with the amount of testing on campus. Many other schools in the Northeast and other schools that are using the facility for testing that Boston College is using, they're testing their students twice per week, where at BC it's more random testing. And some students haven't been tested since they moved in August. So there are definitely people who are concerned that the number of cases that we're seeing reported aren't actually the number of cases that we have on campus.
Right. And the university has appeared to, in the reading and the reporting that I have seen, to blame the coronavirus outbreak on undergraduates who are failing to observe social distancing guidelines. Are students following guidelines? Are they masking up? What are you seeing? What are you reporting in the student newspaper there at Boston College?
Sure. So the Heights has reported that there were some instances where social distancing and masking were ignored, particularly in the freshman residence areas on weekend nights. So we have published stories and photos showing those violations of social distancing. that's not everybody. There certainly are people who are following the rules and people are wearing their masks in class and throughout the day. And some people are following those guidelines on the weekends as well. But we have reported on some instances where that hasn't been the case.
What about at the University of Michigan, Elizabeth? Have there been events that have increased student interaction? I'm talking about tailgates and parties. What have you seen? What have you reported on?
Yeah, so we reported on Welcome Week, which is the week when students start moving in before classes start, always traditionally sees a lot of parties and student gatherings. We did see a lot of gatherings in that week. And I think, you know, people not wearing masks, unclear if, because I know that people tend to live in large houses here, unclear if everyone was from the same house or quarantine pod. And I think people are very, very concerned about when football comes back, about what that will mean in terms of tailgates. Mm. That is such a huge part of Michigan.
It sure is. We'll talk about that in a minute. I want to play this clip. This is an exchange between a police officer and a student. The police officer was breaking up a large gathering at Miami University in Ohio, in Oxford, over Labor Day. Take a listen to this.
I've never seen this before. There's an input on the computer that you tested positive for COVID?
Yes.
When was this?
This was a week ago.
Are you supposed to be quarantining?
Yeah, that's why I'm at my house.
Do you have other people here and you're positive for COVID?
Medic 11.
How many other people have COVID?
They all do.
Everybody has it?
Yeah, and then...
And everybody over here has it?
Well, increase the level of...
I think the two people there, too.
Respond with EMS, 6150 Fairfield Road, 40-year-old female.
That's what we're trying to prevent.
Yeah, I know.
We want to keep this town open.
What the issue is.
That's why I was staying home.
I mean, that clip on so many levels is just so disturbing. More than 1,000 students have tested positive at Miami since August. And the school says they take these violations very seriously. Andy, what do you hear in that, this exchange between a police officer and a student who says, yeah, pretty much a whole house full of folks who have COVID?
Yeah, interactions like that are really, really jarring, obviously, to everyone. And we have seen footage of big parties, of crowded bars. But one thing to point out here, and obviously a big party can do a lot of damage where transmission is concerned. One thing I want to point out here is that my colleague Francie Deep had a story this morning in which she quoted Temple University and Notre Dame University officials as actually saying they see most transmission in small in-person off-campus gatherings. So things that are more casual, like having some friends over to watch a football game and have pizza, more casual gatherings that might not seem as risky to the people involved in them.
So what about that, Colleen, to Andy's point, these small in-person casual off-campus gatherings, that's where the problems really lie. Is that what you're seeing? Is that what you've reported on at Boston College?
You know, it's hard to say because it's nearly impossible for us to know where the cases are coming from unless you're getting an instance like we have at BC where there are certain athletic teams where many members are testing positive. So I really couldn't speak to where the virus is spreading in terms of small gatherings. I don't think it's possible for us to know.
I want to ask both of you, Colleen and Elizabeth, as you're covering the coronavirus outbreak in your student newspapers, I mean, you're navigating some pretty complicated issues, you know, federal privacy laws, HIPAA, FERPA, trying to keep the universities in check with regard to the information they're giving you as reporters. How is your relationship with the university? Have they been transparent with you? Have they been honest with you? Elizabeth, you first.
Yeah, so I think we've had a pretty good relationship in terms of getting a response or some sort of information from our university's public affairs office. I think that they're, in general, though, and this includes with us and everyone else on campus, the university either does not have the data that is necessary on COVID cases or is just not willing to be super transparent about it. Mm. And yeah, obviously, the privacy concerns you said. Yeah. But yeah.
Colleen, what's it like at Boston College? Are they being honest with you? Or are they being open and transparent?
I would say that BC is similar to what Elizabeth mentioned, that there are definitely people calling for more transparency and for the number of cases at Boston College to be updated on a more frequent basis. So there could definitely be an improvement in communication from what we've seen on our end as the student newspaper, but that's something that has also been called for by students and parents as well.
Real quick before we go, Elizabeth, I guess your sports editors are happy they'll be able to cover college football. Yes, no?
Yes, yes, they are happy.
And how do you think that'll all impact kind of the collision between this virus and campus activities?
Yeah, I mean, football just, I think, will always create more campus circulation and bring more people to Ann Arbor. And I'm not even sure how much the university can control in terms of, you know, season ticket holders coming back and just big Michigan football fans. So I think anything that's going to bring a lot of people back and create a lot of cause for interaction could be dangerous.
Well, we'll be watching, and we're grateful for you both taking the time to be with us today. Elizabeth Lawrence, editor-in-chief of the Michigan Daily, the student newspaper at the University of Michigan, where they've had a bumpy ride reopening this fall. Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Colleen Martin, president and editor-in-chief of The Heights, the student newspaper at Boston College. Colleen, good luck to you, and stay safe there. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Jane.
Andy Thomason, stick with me. We are discussing what college students are experiencing this fall semester, whether their schools are having in-person learning or not. And when we come back, we'll talk to two student newspaper editors whose schools are virtual. They may not be keeping students out of town. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. Well, on Monday, we'll extend this conversation. We'll talk about K through 12 schools. Most kids are already back to school, maybe online, hybrid, or in person. But is it really the best we can come up with? We'll talk with two professors of education about how we might rethink education and the way forward. Teachers, educators, tell us how you're approaching school right now. What's working? What's not? And students and parents, how are you coping? We'd love to hear your story. 617-353-0683. This hour, we're speaking with Andy Thomason of the Chronicle for Higher Education and college students about their experiences this fall so far. Let me bring in now from Highlands Ranch, Colorado, John Ort. He's editor-in-chief of the Daily Princetonian, the student newspaper at Princeton University. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for having me today.
It's great to have you. And Pascal Albright joins us from Tucson, Arizona. Pascal is managing editor of the Daily Wildcat, the student newspaper at the University of Arizona. Pascal, thanks you for being here. Great to have you.
Thank you so much, Jane, for having me.
So an extraordinary year for you, as we've been discussing, not only as students, but as journalists covering some remarkable events. John Ort, I'll start with you. What's it been like so far, the start of this school year at Princeton?
Thanks so much, Jane. Of course, it's been the start of a semester like no other. I think that we've encountered a lot of challenges and challenges that are distinct even from the spring, where halfway through the semester became remote. But now that we're sort of starting exclusively online, people are really trying to, you know, maintain community, and especially for incoming students, people who have been away from campus for a long time, thinking about how they can, you know, build relationships, build friendships, and kind of take advantage of all that college has to offer. And so, you know, both with our college paper, and I think more broadly for Princeton students and students across the nation, this is a very real challenge.
Pascal, how are you faring at the University of Arizona, you and your fellow classmates?
We're doing all right. So right now, it's been very interesting with online learning being the main focus. That doesn't mean students aren't on campus because, of course, Arizona weather is something different. But we're seeing a bunch of different things happening, both good and bad across campus, things that are working and clearly things that aren't working and that need to change.
So let's start with the positive first. What's good? What is working?
So we're seeing that an increase in online classes and moving away from the hybrid course where earlier talks were come mid-October, some courses were going to move into in-person after doing a few months of online. But from right now, we're seeing that that's not going to happen, which is a good thing. Another thing is that there's a lot more resources being offered to students, especially virtually, and those accommodations are being made through campus health and our CAPS program. So for mental health awareness and all those things, which is awesome.
That's great. And what's not working so well?
So and something that's not working is that while we do have an online focus learning, there are still students on campus. There are still students in dorms and in the surrounding community, in the high rises, and of course, living around the university. And that means that there's activity happening at the university. And we can see that in our coronavirus cases and their numbers rising.
And how many cases do you have there?
So as our most recent data, as of of the 17th, we had 123 new cases, totaling almost 2,000 total positive cases since the start of the semester.
Wow. John Ort, what about at Princeton? Are students back on campus to some degree? Are there any students in the dorms? Everybody at home? What's the story?
Yep, that's a great question. And Pascal, it was really interesting to hear from you because I think it is distinct at Princeton from Arizona. So at Princeton, there's a very small number of students who have returned. These are students who have been specially invited to come back to campus. And so they include Army ROTC cadets. They include seniors who need access to lab facilities to conduct thesis research. And they also include students who have submitted emergency housing requests and for personal reasons need to live on campus in order to continue learning. But it's a very small group of students that, you know, I think, I don't know the exact number, but, you know, can't be more than around 100. And I think what we're seeing there is that, you know, campus life is very much restricted. People are, you know, picking up meals and eating them in their dorm rooms. Everyone is living in their own room. People are tested for the coronavirus twice a week. And so, you know, of the sort of, you know, the university does maybe 4,000 or so tests a week. And so far, only four or five of those have been coming back positive each week.
Wow. Pascal mentioned some of the resources that are more widely available now during the pandemic. John, you've talked about some of the inequalities that have surfaced during this time with some students at Princeton who don't have access to stable Wi-Fi and other things like that. I'm curious how that has been covered by the paper, how you have seen the university respond.
It's a great question. You know, I think right off the bat in March when the pandemic, you know, totally upended campus life, the university did take some proactive measures. And I'm glad you brought up this issue of Wi-Fi because I think it's really important. And the university had a policy of students could apply to receive funds to, you know, purchase a stronger Wi-Fi signal for their, you know, for their homes if they were having to Zoom into class. As far as the paper goes, though, it's, you know, it's something that we've tried to be attuned to, and I think that has guided our coverage in many ways, thinking about, you know, the disproportionate and widely variable impacts of this pandemic and how students are living it. And so, you know, one of the ways that we've tried to understand how this pandemic is unfolding and how it's affecting students differently is really to listen. And so, you know, across a variety of media, so we have sort of our traditional reporting and written articles, but we also have podcasts and video projects. And we've tried to feature students, you know, from a wide variety of contexts. So I'm thinking we aired a video a few months ago where we spoke with international students and they were able to reflect on some of the challenges of, you know, Zooming into class 10 hours ahead of, you know, the East Coast. Or we've spoken to other students, you know, this is related, but, you know, with the summer's reckoning with racial injustice and what it's like to be taking classes online and be isolated from campus and yet advocating for change. And so, we've really tried to ask those questions and to hear from students.
Andy Thomason, jump in here because I'd like you to broaden that out. It's such an important point. The resources that are available to kids and the inequalities that have surfaced during this. What have you seen more broadly speaking across the country at colleges and universities?
Well, this has been a constant issue to varying degrees at different institutions, depending on what type of college they are. And this idea, which is true, obviously, that so many college students are reliant on so many aspects of the on-campus experience, including mental health counseling and other things like that, and the structure, this was a key variable that college leaders stated in the decision to reopen to some degree in person. And that was consistent across several different institution types, public universities, privates, and HBCUs. We talked to Fauna from Spelman earlier today, and it reminded me of a conversation that I had with the president of Benedict College in Columbia, South Carolina, earlier this year. And she basically said, one of the main reasons we're reopening in person is our student body is predominantly low income, vulnerable. They need this campus experience, and that's need with a capital N. They need it. And so that was a key decision point for her. But it, as I said, it is something that's playing out all across the country at all different sorts of institutions.
Yeah, it's a good question. Pascal Albright, you know, the cost of college, of course, at the forefront of many people's minds right now. And I've heard some students say during this time, why am I paying full tuition to watch online lectures from my couch? You know, do you feel that way? Yeah. How are students reckoning with this?
That's a big topic and conversation that's happening all across campus. It's because, correct, you're paying for all these amenities and resources, and you can't use the library every time, like every single day. You cannot use the rec center every single time. There's certain time slots now. And so there's a big debate on, like, some students I know are requesting refunds or are trying to be in contact with administration to see if there can be some sort of discount or some other amenities that can be added, because students are upset. Especially we hear a lot from first year students that want this whole college experience, but during a pandemic, of course, it's going to be different, and yeah, there's frustration.
Yeah. Let me play this clip. On Point listener Jack left us this message explaining why he chose not to return to the University of Vermont for his sophomore year this fall.
I am instead choosing to work doing carpentry in Vermont near my house, and I've as a way to save money on an education that I don't think is as valuable as the cost is currently, and hopefully to ride out some of the worse effects of the virus and the effects on, you know, the social experience of college, and, you know, the clubs and stuff that I've joined and the limitations that coronavirus has placed on those.
John Ort from Princeton, jump back in here. I mean, how do you – Princeton education is not cheap. I mean, can colleges justify full tuition right now under these conditions?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, colleges – every college really finds itself in this dilemma, you know, where to a certain extent institutions rely on tuition revenue and also rely on the integrity of their degree, right, and don't want to, you know, insinuate anything about the education their students are receiving by reducing tuition. And yet – as you said, Jane, there's such stark differences this year. In Princeton's case, there was a 10% reduction in sticker price tuition. And so this is kind of, you know, a discount that was applied to the full cost of tuition. But we were talking earlier about inequities. I mean, it's been a debate on campus and a serious one about what the ramifications are for low-income students. The way that the university structured its decision, it still expects students to meet what's called the student contribution. And so, you know, the sort of effective result is that, you know, students who pay full tuition, who are able to, are seeing reduced costs, while other students might still have to, you know, maintain jobs. Universities moved a lot of campus jobs online and might still be expected to be contributing money towards their education. So I would say that it's very much unresolved right now at Princeton. It's a conversation people are having. There's, you know, some people are very understandably frustrated by the decision that's been made. And it is this really tricky dilemma.
Andy Thomason, back to you to sort of broad picture this for us. Can colleges justify full tuition right now? And what are the ramifications for, you know, a lot of low-income students who just can't afford this. There was our listener in Vermont saying, I got to save some money. You know, I can't do this.
Well, yeah, what I would say about Jack, your listener, is that one big worry that people have about this crisis is that there will be Jacks out there who decide to take a year off, do not enroll, and then they never enroll. Right. There's this concept in American higher education, summer melt, this idea that lots of students who get admitted to a college end up not enrolling because life gets in the way. And this could be summer melt on steroids. This could be a whole class of students who never enroll. That's really worrying. What I would say about college tuition is that what a college would probably tell you about keeping tuition relatively stable, even in this crisis, is that they have lots of costs that are fixed, you know, payroll stuff, what they pay faculty. The faculty are still working. They still need to be paid. And so they can't really cut corners on that cost. That's one thing that they would tell you. But big picture, this could become a trust issue for colleges because many colleges have bought into this notion or embraced it that, you know, a college degree from an American university is a product. And when you embrace that notion, you are on the hook for when your product doesn't deliver what you said it would. And so it could be a thing into the future where students who had unpleasant experiences, parents who had to pay full tuition for a year that was like no other year, they might trust American colleges a little bit less than they did before. Mm.
I mentioned earlier Northeastern University expelling 11 students who'd gathered in a room together. They have refunded just yesterday the $36,000 in tuition. So that's good news for those kids. Pascal Albright, how do you see this moving forward? Are kids, do they have the patience? Do students have the patience to sort of wait this out and continue with good behavior, to mask up, to stop going to parties, that sort of thing?
So this is actually interesting. So as of earlier this week was one of the first times that our president actually acknowledged that students were not choosing to wear masks and are gathering in large groups through an email that he sent out to the university and all the students. And that is after a day after the university and Pima County put into place a recommended 14-day shelter in place for students and or near campus. However, we are seeing that this recommendation is not being followed. Students are still on campus, maybe not as much during the day because we do get hotter temperatures, but once the sun goes down, we see a huge number of crowds on campus, students gathering even and like around campus in houses. We see larger numbers, whether they all live there, we don't know, but we're getting reports via Twitter from students and through our social media platforms, like telling us that this stay in shelter in place recommendation is not happening. And so it'll be really interesting to see how this goes. And right now the university is not taking any enforcement action to make sure that this 14-day is taking place. Mm. And this also brings another thing. Testing is also not mandatory for students right now on campus. It is. So the only time most students are getting campus is if they've interacted with larger crowds or if they're worried that they have coronavirus.
Yeah, yeah. It's so different in every place. John Ott, I'll give you the last word here. How have your expectations for college life changed? How will they change looking ahead and really what your future looks like after going through this?
Absolutely. That's also such an important question. And you know, I think that we've had time to, you know, for all college students to process, right, you know, the fact that this pandemic isn't going to disappear overnight, and that for a lot of college students, especially people who are seniors, you know, their sort of quote unquote normal college days are probably over. And if anything, I think that's, you know, that's led for a lot of people, including myself, to a recognition of, you know, how important, you know, friendships and relationships are, and how important it is to try to, you know, maintain what was so important to us in college. And so even though that's over Zoom, I think we're seeing that people are really making a concerted effort, you know, even if it can't be in person, thinking about how they can serve their campus community and how they can be there for one another.
Well, let's hope that you do have a graduation in person this May. Lots to happen in between in the meantime. We appreciate so much you being here with us today. John Ott, editor-in-chief of the Daily Princetonian. John, thank you.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Pascal Albright in Tucson, Arizona. Pascal, thank you.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Thank you. And Annie Thomason, as always, senior editor of the Chronicle for Higher Education. Andy, we really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Thank you. Listeners, thanks as always. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.